From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The Royal Tenenbaums, a film about a dysfunctional family of geniuses, just came out on video and DVD. A lot of critics put the film on their 2001 10 Best lists. On today's Fresh Air, we feature an interview with director and co-writer Wes Anderson. Also, we hear from film producer Robert Evans. The story of his rise and fall is told in the new documentary, The Kid Stays in the Picture. He headed Paramount Studios when it made some of the classic films of the late 60s and 70s, like Rosemary's Baby, Chinatown, and The Godfather. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews Wayne Shorter's new CD, and film critic John Powers reviews the French thriller Read My Lips. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush went to Capitol Hill today to push Republican members of Congress to support his bid for expanded authority to negotiate trade deals. NPR's Don Gagne reports from the White House.
The U.S. House is preparing to vote on trade promotion authority, and the outcome is expected to be so close that the president felt it necessary to pay a personal visit to the House Republican caucus. His goal is to pressure members of his own party to stick together and to make sure there are no Republican defections. With such power, which lapsed in 1994, the president would be able to negotiate trade deals which could then be approved or rejected by Congress, but not modified in any way. The president promotes international trade as a way to create jobs for Americans, but critics, including labor unions, worry about job losses in the U.S., particularly in the manufacturing sector and in the textile industry. A compromise worked out in a Senate committee would boost aid for workers who are displaced. Don Gagne, NPR News, Washington.
Police in suburban St. Louis say they found a body believed to be that of a 6-year-old girl who was reported missing this morning. They say they've arrested a 24-year-old man who was staying at the same house where Cassandra Williamson had spent the night with her father. The child's body was found late this afternoon at an abandoned factory a few blocks from her father's home. The case is the most recent in a string of child abductions that have drawn national attention in recent weeks. Rescue workers in Somerset, Pennsylvania, say they've recovered a broken drill bit that's been hindering efforts to reach 9 miners who are trapped in a flooded mine shaft. Reporter Jeff Young says the rescuers are hoping the trapped men can hold out.
There have been no fresh indications of sounds from the air shaft. The only signs of life are these faint tapping noises. The last time those were confirmed were midday yesterday. Now, officials are also quick to point out that it might just be that all the noise at the surface is making it from the drilling equipment is making it difficult for them to hear the men in their attempts to tap out some message of contact. The families we hear via officials are remaining hopeful, and when they received news of the work beginning anew on that deeper hole, a big cheer went up. So it seems like they're keeping the faith.
Reporter Jeff Young of West Virginia Public Radio. In stocks today, the Dow Jones Industrials gained 78 points, or about 1%, to close at 8,264 in very heavy trading of more than 1.8 billion shares. For the week, the Dow gained 245 points. The Nasdaq gained 22 points, or 1.8%, to close at 1,262. The Nasdaq was down 57 for the week. The S&P 500 gained 14 points. This is NPR News. The U.S. Military Central Command says rumors of an ambush attack on U.S. troops in Afghanistan are false. A military spokesman denied a television report from Abu Dhabi that said an ambush left 7 American soldiers dead and 14 wounded in eastern Afghanistan. A federal jury has convicted 2 self-avowed white supremacists of plotting to blow up Jewish and black landmarks. Prosecutors say Leo Felton and Erica Chase were hoping to incite what they called a racial holy war. Philip Martin reports from Boston.
The all-white jury met for nearly 7 hours over 2 days. In the end, they rejected defense arguments that their clients were being prosecuted because of their political beliefs. Felton and Chase were found guilty of conspiring to make a bomb, conspiring to produce counterfeit bills, obstruction of justice, conspiracy to obstruct justice, and firearms violations. In addition, Felton was found guilty on the charges of making counterfeit bills, bank robbery, conspiracy to commit bank robbery, and attempting to receive explosives, with the intent to kill or injure people or damage property. Felton, the son of a white mother and a black father, was a member of the White Order of Thule, and Chase was considered a rising star in the World Church of the Creator, a white supremacist organization. Felton faces at least 35 years in prison, and Chase 8 years or more. For NPR News, I'm Philip Martin in Boston.
Some candidates for statewide office in Florida may have lost their qualifying paperwork in the crash of a cargo jet. The FedEx Boeing 727 jet crashed just short of the runway today at Tallahassee Regional Airport. The three crew members on board escaped without serious injuries, but the plane burned, destroying much of its cargo. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from American Legacy Foundation, informing Americans that over 178,000 women die every year from smoking. www.americanlegacy.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. One of the best movies of 2001 has just come out on video and DVD, The Royal Tenenbaums. It appeared on a lot of critics' 2001 10 Best lists. Wes Anderson directed and co-wrote the film. Anderson also made the films Bottle Rocket and Rushmore. We're going to listen back to the interview I recorded last December when The Royal Tenenbaums was released. It's a comedy about a dysfunctional family of geniuses. Royal Tenenbaum, played by Gene Hackman, and his wife Etheline, played by Angelica Houston, separated when their children were young. Royal is part businessman, part con man. He runs a lot of emotional swindles on his family. He's never accepted his adopted daughter as an authentic member of the family. The three Tenenbaum kids were child geniuses, but when they grew up, they were each stunted by family disasters and betrayals. The grown-up children are played by Ben Stiller, Gwyneth Paltrow, and Luke Wilson. In this scene, the father, Royal, is broke. He owes so much money to the luxury hotel he's been living in that he's been evicted. Having no place to go, he tries to return to the Tenenbaum home, where he knows he will not be welcome. So he needs a scheme. He tells the family he's dying of cancer and wants to reconcile.
I've missed the hell out of you, my darlings. Well, you know that, though, don't you?
I hear you're dying.
So they tell me.
I'm sorry.
Well, I've had a good run.
You don't look so sick, Dad.
Thank you.
What have you got?
I got a pretty bad case of cancer.
Ugh, how long are you gonna last?
Not long.
A month? A year?
About 6 weeks. Let me get to the point. The three of you and your mother are all I've got, and I love you more than anything. Chaz, let me finish here. I've got 6 weeks to set things right with you, and I aim to do it. Will you give me a chance?
No.
You speak for everyone?
I speak for myself.
Well, you've made your views known. I'll let somebody else do some of the talking now.
What do you propose to do?
I can't say, really. Make up for lost time, I suppose. First thing I want to do is take you out to see your grandmother at some point.
I haven't been out there since I was six.
I haven't been out there at all. I was never invited.
Well, she wasn't your real grandmother, and I never knew how much interest you had, sweetie. Anyway, you're invited now.
Thanks.
Dysfunctional family is perhaps the most common subject now in contemporary fiction and in a lot of movies. What made you think that you could take on the subject and still have something else to say? It seems like so much has already been said.
Yeah, well, my writing partner, Owen Wilson, and I, he'd always been encouraging me to write about my parents' divorce. He always thought there was something there that would be a good basis for something. And so that's what I thought we were doing, but the more we worked on the script, the less it had anything to do with my family or my parents' divorce, and the more it was sort of invented, and the more dysfunctional it became. It kind of just went off on its own. So I sort of feel like as we developed it, we invented a lot of new things, and then it kind of started to find its way back to people that we knew, and little bits of things from real life. But it was sort of like when it became not about my family that it started to get really severe.
Well, there is a line I particularly liked about divorce in the movie when Gene Hackman is explaining to the three children that he and his wife are separating, that the parents are separating. One of the kids says, "Daddy, is it our fault?" And he says, "Well, it's true, we did have to make many sacrifices to have you children."
Yeah, the worst thing, an honest answer is probably a terrible idea under those situations.
Did you pop the question and get an answer like that when your parents were divorcing?
Well, that's funny because that scene, there's a scene, you know, where they're talking to their father about are they going to split up, and that's a real scene I have two brothers, and the three of us had this conversation with our father, but none of the father's answers are anything like what my father said. Every answer that the Gene Hackman character gives is the truth, which has got to be highly destructive to the children.
So your father gave you the right answers?
He gave us the right answers, yeah.
Each of the children in the Tenenbaum family has a certain look that they stick with through all or most of the movie. I'd like you to choose a couple of characters and talk about the look that you gave them and why.
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing in the story is that they're all sort of they're sort of stuck emotionally in the same place where they were 20 years ago, and they're also stuck in terms of the clothes that they wear and the way their rooms look and everything. It's all sort of just cemented in about 1978. So the tennis player that Luke Wilson plays, Richie, is he wears a headband for the whole movie. He always looks like he's just about to head out to the courts, even though he hasn't picked up a racket in 6 years or something. And his whole look is sort of modeled on Bjorn Borg in the late 70s.
Right.
Gwyneth Paltrow, her character is sort of wears one of these like fourth grader Lacoste dresses that looks like a big shirt and a mink coat. I don't know why those go together, but somehow they seem to. And penny loafers. And you know, Ben Stiller goes through the whole movie in a red Adidas warm-up that identical to the ones worn by his two sons. And I think the idea for that, I was just sort of thinking they could always spot each other in a crowd. It's like for safety purposes. He's obsessed with their safety. So
because his wife died in a plane crash.
Right.
Then there's the boy next door who desperately wants to be part of the Tenenbaum family and is always showing up at the door when he's a child. The grown-up version of this character is played by Owen Wilson, who's also your screenwriting partner for the film. Are you familiar with this kind of character, or is this kind of character based on you? Was there a family in your life that you really envied because they had such like an interesting house and interesting parents and
creative
siblings?
No, very much. I mean, as much as sort of devoted as I am to my own family, I do remember a series of families over the years that I always was trying to get myself adopted into. Because of the things that were going on in their houses, and that's definitely where this Eli Cash character that Owen plays comes from. That's actually a good example of what's invented in the movie and what comes from real life, and hopefully kind of how we rely on both of those things, because the character that he plays is initially this sort of concoction of a kind of a Cormac McCarthy, but it would be like Cormac McCarthy if he was living in New York and going out to cocktail parties every night. He's a Western novelist, but I think he wouldn't be very comfortable on horseback. You know, I think his fringe leather jackets are custom made, probably in L.A. but the real kind of heart of that character has to do with his. Him growing up, you know, across the street from this family that he really wanted to be a part of, and his kind of longing to be one of them.
Wes Anderson is my guest. He directed and co-wrote The Royal Tenenbaums. The story of The Royal Tenenbaums is set in New York, but it's an idealized version of the city, and all the landmarks are fake. Instead of the 92nd Street Y, there's the 375th Street Y. I don't think there even is a 375th Street.
Yeah, I think the 375th Street Y would probably be in Yonkers.
Right, right. Yeah. Why did you want to shoot in New York but have a kind of fake version of New York that you were operating with?
One thing that was one of the my sort of initial thoughts about it, I often kind of am thinking about the setting before much of anything else, And I just had this idea of this sort of exaggerated version of New York. And I feel like, and you know, which is just fun to make up all the details to the place, but also I feel like it sort of creates a setting where the kind of unusual behavior of the characters can seem appropriate somehow, because the setting is so exaggerated and is a little bit unreal.
And why did you set your movie in New York?
Well, because I've always had this sort of semi-obsession with New York and all the things that I've felt like it represented, you know, having to do a lot of which came from the New Yorker magazine, which was my consistent exposure to New York for you know, all through high school. And I always felt like it seemed like people were up to so many different things around the city. All these people had their own little projects, and that's kind of what the movie is partly about, I think. And then I live there now, so it's kind of a big thing for me.
In your movie, The Royal Tenenbaums, the family lives in, well, this almost mansion in New York. It's an old building with a turret. I think you'd call that a turret, the rounded.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, with a flag on the top.
Yeah. Now, I read about you as a kid. You used to draw pictures of dream mansions that you would have liked to live in. How did you get that sense of place, that sense of interest in mansions?
Well, you know, for a little while I wanted to be an architect, but I was also, along with being interested in buildings, I was also, for a period of time, I'm embarrassed to say that I was obsessed with being rich. I was interested in limousines, and I was interested in mansions, and I was interested in the fanciest restaurants, and it was like a James Bond kind of thing that I was really drawn to. I wanted to learn how to play Baccarat, and so I think between the ages of about 8 and 12 or something, that was what I was reading about.
My guest is Wes Anderson. He directed and co-wrote the movie The Royal Tenenbaums. It just came out on video and DVD. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our interview with Wes Anderson. He directed and co-wrote the film The Royal Tenenbaums. It just came out on video and DVD. I want to ask you something about the pacing of the movie. Early on in The Royal Tenenbaums, you're just finding out detail after detail about each of the children in the family. And there's so many like sight gags and verbal jokes, and it's just like one laugh after another. And the plot isn't necessarily advancing, but the character detail is. And at some point you're wondering, when is this going to slow down and the real story will evolve? And at about that point, it slows down and the story evolves. Mm-hmm. And I'm just wondering if you could talk a little bit about pacing the film and what you had to figure out with that.
Right. I was always a little worried because we do spend quite a bit of time on, basically what happens is we give this whole story of the family history, then we introduce each character today. And there are 8 main characters, and we introduce them in the bluntest way you can. We show an image of them with the name of the character and the name of the actor, and we go on to the next one. Then we go to the present. We revisit each in the present, and a narrator kind of walks us through where they are now. So we end up doing kind of 3 tours through all the characters, and it takes up the entire first reel of the movie. And I was always worried, can we do this? Can we spend this much time laying the groundwork? But I was also worried that if we didn't, it would just be completely confusing because there's so many characters and what they're up to is not really a very familiar territory. We were very conscious that once that was done, we needed to get right into the story. It may require some patience.
The song that really stands out that you used in your previous movie, Rushmore, was Summer Song by Chad and Jeremy. Talk about how you chose the records that you use in the background for the Royal Tenenbaums.
Right. Well, for me, the songs are always a part of the writing process. When we were doing Rushmore, I had this idea of British Invasion, and I just listened to lots of that, and I had some favorites that I liked. There's a song called Making Time by a band called The Creation that almost became like sort of the theme of the movie, I think. It sort of led me into this whole British Invasion thing. And the new movie, I felt like there was a song by Nico, it was written by Jackson Browne, but sung by Nico, and there was also this Ravel string quartet in F major. These two pieces of music I had from the beginning, and somehow I felt like there was something kind of half Scott Fitzgerald and half Velvet Underground that was going to be the sort of sound of the movie. And in a way, so it almost influenced the way the movie looks, I think, because when you're outside in the movie, it's a little bit like sort of 70s New York. There's a lot of graffiti and stuff, and it's kind of like the French Connection or the Warriors period of New York. But the rooms inside feel like maybe they're more like the 30s or something. Or I don't know what. I feel like that sort of came out of the mixture of music, there is something to me sort of New York about a lot of the music, even though it's, you know, even though there's Beatles and there's Van Morrison, and there's something about the feeling of these songs that makes me think of New York.
You have some great actors in the Royal Tenenbaums, and Gene Hackman's at the center of the movie, and he's just so much fun to watch. I know you worked really hard to convince him to star in the film. What did you learn about how he works?
Well, I think he's quite different in his approach to a scene from anybody else I've worked with. There's something about him where he wants to be. He's very prepared when he arrives to do a scene, but he somehow manages to make it completely spontaneous as soon as he launches into it. And I don't think he even really knows what he just did after he finishes a take. He somehow manages to sort of take all this preparation and then just block it out and just dive into the scene. So whenever you're starting a scene with him, there's this real feeling of his attack to it and this energy that he brings to it. And it's very different from other actors who I've worked with. A lot of actors, which I enjoy also, is, you know, people who want to discuss it and think about it and want to try some different approaches. He likes to figure it out and then just launch right into it. What I really think he likes to do is to be great on the first take and just immediately, you know, grab a hold of it.
You've worked with Owen Wilson on your three movies. He's co-written them and he's starred in two of them. How did you meet?
Owen and I met, we went to school together in Austin, and we had a playwriting class together. We didn't actually meet in the playwriting class. We were in this class together with about five other people, but we were both the sort of non-participants in the room. Owen would just sit in the corner reading the newspaper, and I sat in the other corner. I was trying to write something during the class, but neither of us really quite joined in. But I think we recognized each other as kindred spirits or something. And then we met, you know, shortly after that. I think I met him in the halls. He asked me about which creative writing class he ought to take. And he acted like we already knew each other. So I acted like we already knew each other, too.
Has it been interesting to know each other for so long and both end up with pretty successful careers?
I think we've been really lucky to have each other as we kind of figure out all this movie stuff because I think it can be pretty easy to lose your bearings a little bit. You know, I feel like the Coen brothers, those guys seem so secure in their whole approach to movies, and they seem just very, like, and I feel like the two of them going through all the stuff together have really helped to keep each other quite focused and sort of on track. And I feel like, you know, I'm glad to have had Owen and Luke also, and just to sort of, so we could sort of guide each other a little bit.
Your movie has a kind of generosity of spirit, even though it's a comedy about a dysfunctional family and everybody's totally screwed up. There's a spirit of forgiveness, finally, and a sense that the good of family can really outweigh the bad. Is it easy for you to feel as generous in real life, both about family and about people maybe within the family who you've had to forgive?
I don't feel like I've had... my experiences with the family are not really like the ones in the movie, so I don't really feel that... well, I don't know. I guess everybody has a certain amount of that stuff. What I feel like is that the movies that we make, I'm drawn to some kind of optimism or something about the characters, and I want to have an affection for the characters. And I also feel like we're drawn to characters that are very flawed and capable of very questionable behavior. But somehow I always feel like I don't want to have bad guys. And I don't know exactly how that relates to how I feel in real life. But I don't know. That's the kind of movie that I'm drawn to.
Well, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
Yeah, of course. Thank you.
Wes Anderson directed and co-wrote the film The Royal Tenenbaums. It's just been released on video and DVD. Our interview was recorded in December when the movie was released theatrically. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, and by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And by Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of Saving Your Brain, the revolutionary plan to boost brain power, improve memory, and protect yourself against aging and Alzheimer's by Jeff Victoroff, MD. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, making the movies Chinatown and The Godfather, we hear from film producer Robert Evans. He's the subject of the new documentary, The Kid Stays in the Picture. Also, Kevin Whitehead reviews Wayne Shorter's new CD, and John Powers reviews the French thriller Read My Lips.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Saxophonist Wayne Shorter was a key figure in Art Blakey's Jazz Messengers and the Miles Davis Quintet in the 1960s, and in the electric band Weather Report in the 70s and 80s. He's also one of the most influential composers in modern jazz. He made few records in the 90s, but last year he put together a new quartet and took it out on the road, where they recorded a new CD. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says it's a big step in the right direction.
Wayne Shorter's Mascalero. Like most tunes on his new CD, Footprints Live, he wrote it in the 1960s, and like a couple of the others, he wrote it for Miles Davis. The memory of Miles' 60s quintet hangs heavy over this music, like a lot of modern jazz. For some musicians, Miles' band was the end of jazz history. They stretched timing and harmony and the polyrhythmic interplay so far, it's been hard to figure out how to top it. In the 1980s, it was a template for Wynton Marsalis' quintet and umpteen other young bands, and Miles' sidemen have drawn on that model for their own groups. Shorter was its most important and imitated composer. He knows jazz harmony the way a chess master knows the board, but he also has a knack for writing simple tunes that open up possibilities for improvisers. Here's his new band on his classic Footprints. Wayne Shorter with his most sympathetic new ally, Panama-born pianist Danilo Perez. Brian Blade is on drums and John Patitucci on bass. Footprints Live is Shorter's best album in 30 years, which would be more impressive if he hadn't wasted so much of that time on flyweight stuff like the electric band Weather Report. And for decades now, he's played the squealy little soprano sax more than his beefy tenor. But he favors the big horn these days, sounding and looking remarkably like his old self. Shorter thinks like a composer when he improvises. You get ideas more than licks, and he has a rare ability to edit those ideas on the fly. He makes fewer notes count for more by placing them right. Given Shorter's sense of economy, it figures he doesn't hog the solo space as much as you'd wish. His new band knows his music and is ready for anything, but in their enthusiasm, they can overdo it. Footprints Live was recorded on the jazz festival circuit last summer. When musicians play huge venues full of fans jaded by hearing too much jazz in one day, they can be tempted toward a little arena rock showboating. Public adulation may not encourage musicians to improvise responsibly, but it does create a demand for the quartet's services, which gives them a chance to grow. Since the players are all too busy to rehearse, the only place they get to develop is on the bandstand. This summer, they're back on the trail, getting in plenty of practice. Now,
Miles Davis didn't rehearse when Wayne Shorter was in his road band either, and they turned out okay. So here's hoping this group stays together long enough to really hit its stride.
Kevin Whitehead writes for the Chicago Reader and the Chicago Sun-Times. He reviewed Footprints Live by saxophonist and composer Wayne Shorter. Coming up, film producer Robert Evans talks about making The Godfather and Chinatown. He's the subject of the new documentary, The Kid Stays in the Picture. This is Fresh Air. Love Story, Rosemary's Baby, Chinatown, and The Godfather, Parts 1 and 2, were produced by Robert Evans. As the head of production at Paramount, he used to be one of Hollywood's greatest power brokers. But he lost his power and his money when he made The Cotton Club. Not only were there serious behind-the-scenes problems with the film, but one of the potential backers Evans brought on was murdered. Evans was loosely implicated, but never charged. And he was having cocaine problems. He was forced out of Paramount. But he returned in 1992. The new documentary, The Kid Stays in the Picture, tells the story of his rise and fall. It's based on his 1994 memoir. I spoke to him when the book was published. We talked about a couple of the films he produced, starting with The Godfather. Let's hear a scene from near the end of the film. After killing the heads of the five rival mafia families, Michael Corleone returns to the family compound to finish one last piece of business with his brother-in-law, Carlo.
You have to answer for Santino, Carlo.
Mike, you got it all wrong.
Your fingers sent it for the Barzini people. Ah, that little farce you played with my sister. You think that could fool the Corleone?
Mike, I'm innocent. I swear to the kids. Please, Mike, don't do this.
Sit down. Barzini's dead. So is Philip Tattaglia. Mo Green. Stracci. Cuneo. Today I settle all family business, so don't tell me you're innocent, Carlo. Admit what you did. Get him a drink. Come on. Don't be afraid, Carlo. Come on. You think I make my sister a widow? I'm godfather to your son, Carlo. Go ahead, drink. Drink.
Robert Evans told me how he got to produce The Godfather.
I met Mario Puzo as a favor to a literary agent friend of mine named George Weezer. And he needed money to pay off the bookies, actually. And he had this treatment called Mafia. It was 60 pages. And he said the word mafia had never been used before. It was found in the Kefauver Committee. And I was always interested in that kind of a movie. So I gave him $12,000 just to write a treatment called Mafia. And that treatment called Mafia turned into being the novel The Godfather. And we owned the novel for very, very little money, because I put up the money for a treatment. And even after we owned it, and we owned it for next to nothing, they still didn't want to make the picture at Paramount, because too many people said a mafia picture had never been successful, anything about the organization, as it was called before, the mafia. And there had never been one successful film made about the mafia before that. And they wanted me to sell it. and I refused to do it, and we found the reason why there had been no successful mafia films, because they had been made by Jews and not Italians.
Did you think that was the secret?
I must have been, because we had made one 2 years before with Kirk Douglas. It was directed by Marty Ritt, written by Bill Sternberg, starred Luther Adler and Susan Strasberg and Kirk Douglas, all written and directed and produced by Jewish people. And there's a difference, a thin line between a Jew and a Sicilian. And I felt that made the difference. And that's why we gave Francis Coppola his assignment to do it. And by record, he had only made 3 unsuccessful films before that. Phineas Rainbow, You're a Big Boy Now, and Rain People. When I hired Francis to do it, everyone thought I'd lose my job over it.
I should point out, you're Jewish, so it's kind of interesting that you really took a stand that it had to be an Italian.
Well, yes, because I was right in taking that stand. If I would have done it, I most probably wouldn't have made it the same way.
Now, several directors...
I wanted to smell the spaghetti, Derry.
Several directors turned down The Godfather. Costa Gavras, Ilya Kazan, Arthur Penn. Not Italians, yeah.
No Italians. There hadn't been an Italian director, second-generation Italian director in Hollywood at the time, as a matter of fact. It was pre-Martin Scorsese and other Italian directors, and Francis was the only second-generation Italian working in films at the time.
That's how he got
the nod.
That's how he got the gig, because he was the only Italian
around? He got the gig
that way,
and he would only make it one way. If he could tell his story as a family chronicle on capitalism in America. That's the way he described it anyway, but we had no choice at the time. And as I said, I wanted to smell that spaghetti, and one thing we did, we smelled the spaghetti.
You say that when The Godfather was being made, really most people did not want Brando to be cast.
Not most people. Nobody wanted him. Francis wanted him, and I understood why he wanted him. And the only way we got him into the picture was, Francis was brilliant enough to do a silent screen test of him. And once you saw that silent screen test, you knew there's only one person to play the part. It was Marlon. At that point, Marlon's career was very deep into the red. He hadn't made a successful film in years, and he wanted the gig as well. He didn't do it for the artistic purposes. Though he had claimed he had loved the book, I didn't even believe he read it. He wanted the part, and he got the part. And he made history with it, and also made his own second history with making it.
What were your fears about using him?
None. After looking at it, I thought it was a brilliant idea. It was the people who put up the money didn't like it that much. There was a very big producer, an Italian producer, who came in to see the New York office. He said, "If you use a Marlon Brando at playing The Godfather, no one in Italy will ever even go to the movie." It ended up being the biggest film ever in Italy. So that shows how few people know about anything, including myself.
You didn't want to cast Al Pacino.
No, I didn't want Al Pacino, and Francis didn't want Jimmy Caan. So we settled on Al Pacino if he would, and Jimmy Caan as a combination, because it was getting too close to shooting time. And Francis rightfully said to me, "You want someone who looks like you, and I want someone who looks like me. I mean, we're never going to get together in this part." and he didn't want Jimmy Caan at all, because he had just done Rain People with him, and it got rained on pretty good.
Oh, James Caan's Jewish, and you wanted to make a whole big thing about Italians in it.
But the reason I wanted James Caan was because Al is like 5'4 or 5'5, and the guy they wanted to play opposite him as part of Sonny was 6'5, and I didn't want to see Mutton Jeff. And there was a size range. Jimmy looked very big next to Al, but he isn't that big in person. I mean, he's an average-sized guy, 5'10 or so. But the fellow they had wanted to put next to Al, it would have looked cosmetically ludicrous. So that's the reason I went with Jimmy.
You say that when you saw Coppola's first cut, you told him he had to make it longer, that he had to put more in. And that's exactly the opposite of what I'd expect a producer to say. It's usually, the film's too long, you'd better cut it.
And not only that, it was around 2 hours and 6 minutes his cut. And we ended up with a picture close to 3 hours. He had shot everything. He had shot that spaghetti, but he took it out in the edit. He was afraid. And I understand that. The distribution company, the theaters want pictures that are 2 hours so they get turned over. They don't like a 3-hour movie. But this film was not about a slice of life. It was about an era. And it's not a little picture. The canvas was there to make it hold. You see, sometimes the longer a film is, the shorter it plays. And the shorter it is, the longer it plays, because if you lose the text, if it's one single dimensional, it can play awfully long at 90 minutes, and it can play short at 3 hours. And we took a real chance of letting it play long. If it would have played short, it would have been The Untouchables.
You say the ending was really a mess, that there was no ending.
That's correct. There was no ending, and we had a lot of mayhem.
What was the ending like?
It wasn't written. Mm-hmm. There wasn't an ending. We were going to edit the ending. And neither Francis nor myself came up with that edit, as I talk about in the book. A man named Peter Zinner, who is one of the two editors, choreographed the mixture of the baptism of young Michael and the mass killings that went on. And it was very operatic. And Francis is a very operatic director. And he loved what he saw when it was edited together that way, though it wasn't written that way. And so many films have emulated that ending. It's among the classic endings in film history. And nothing to do with either Francis or my own talents. It was Peter Zinner's extraordinary eye to and rhythm that made that baptism ending work.
You produced Chinatown, a great movie. You cast Jack Nicholson as the leading man in this. Why did you want him?
First of all, he had never played a straight leading man before. Secondly, I've always looked at Jack, and I discovered him, actually, not discovered him for film, but for big-time film, when he was in a Barbra Streisand picture on A Clear Day. Jack has a smile. Before he even opens his mouth, the rafters shake when he smiles. It's a billion-dollar smile. And when he starts to speak, he's mesmerizing. I think he stands alone. He stood alone then. He stands alone now as the single actor who both the young and the old relate to. And I wanted to just do a film with him. And Jack had not played this kind of a straight part before, so he wanted the courage to try to play a straight part and not use props of parts that he'd done before. So that's how he added in playing the part. His natural instinct, however, was to do something that was different, and that's how he and Roman came up with the idea of that blade going into his nose and cutting his nose wide open, and watching the cast going down to then a bandage, and the bandage less and then the scar less all through the movie was a brilliant conceptual move, and it was subliminal. You didn't realize it, but it was a great character hook for Jack to play that role. And I must tell you, when people first saw Chinatown, they looked at each other. They thought it was done in Chinese. They didn't understand it. They got to understand it pretty quick, though. It holds up today as well as it was when it was made then. And very few pictures hold up after 20, 30 years as well as Chinatown, hold up at all. The styles change.
I'm always very amused by how movies might have been cast and how they might have turned out differently. And so I was very amused to hear that when you were making Chinatown, you say Jane Fonda was everybody's first choice to play opposite Jack Nicholson. I don't think that would have worked at all.
It wouldn't have worked nearly as well. It's all strange. Everything is what's called, quote, fashionable at the time. Jane's career at that particular moment was hotter than Faye's. Faye's is more correct for the role, but everyone's star plays all the time. I was thrilled to get Faye because she had the neuroses for this part that made it really work. You know, the part is only 7 or 8 scenes, but yet the texture of the way it's written and the mystery of the way it's written makes it as memorable as a part as she's had in her career, even though she didn't win the Academy Award for it, she was nominated for it. Chinatown was nominated for 11 Academy Awards, and no one understood the picture when it was finished. How about that?
Well, you say that Robert Towne, who wrote Chinatown, is still really angry with you about how the ending of Chinatown was changed. So how was it changed compared to what Robert Towne had originally written?
Well, Robert wanted and was definite upon it. He wanted the character that John Huston was playing to be killed at the end, and Roman wanted the Faye Dunaway character to be killed. And he felt it was more unique that way, that evil did win out at the end, and thus it didn't make it a, quote, Hollywood movie. And Robert thought Roman's thought was demented. And I was a swing vote in it, and I went along with Roman. And to this day, Bob Towne thinks it's a mistake. There's one thing, he won the Academy Award for it, but I suppose that doesn't matter. He still thinks it would have been better the other way. I mean, to this day, if you had him on your show, he'd tell you that.
But I think he did.
I'm sure he must have. He only became the biggest writer in town. Not to use a pun, but Towne became the biggest writer in town from Chinatown.
So that famous line, "It's Chinatown, Jake," that's said at the end probably wouldn't have been said at the end if the original.
It would have been. It would have been said anyway, but it wouldn't have made sense. See, Chinatown was not supposed to be, per se, Chinatown. It wasn't about Chinatown. It was a state of mind.
Right. Well, you know, I think today it's very difficult to make a movie where evil does win, unless it's evil winning in a kind of monster movie, so there can be a sequel where the monster returns.
You're right. Today is not... Making movies today is very much different than it was making them 20 years ago. Everything is by committee today, and the numbers are so big, maybe there's reason for it. You know, there's no such word as an independent producer. Everyone's a dependent producer, including yours truly. The only time you're independent is when you use your own money. When you use other people's money, they're the ones who are independent, and you're dependent upon their money. And it's an industry where everybody is overpaid, including myself. And when you're overpaid, it's not so easy to duplicate your position in life, so you become, unfortunately, dependent and not independent. And films today are subject to scrutiny because the budgets are so high and costs of marketing are so high that they're not left up to the integrity of the artist, and maybe rightfully so. A distribution is a tremendous voice in what happens to the film, and the front executive office is of the same. And you're just part of a consortium as to what is being made, how it's being made, and how it's to be released. It is, at the very best, to say that it's frustrating, but I understand it.
You were one of the, boy genius producers. You were very young when you got started. You were very young when you took over Paramount. Did you have to fake it at the beginning before you had any real experience?
Well, I've always been a gambler. And the business has always been made up of gamblers, the Louis B. Mayers, the Harry Cohns, the Jack Warners. If you study their lives, the David Selznicks, Sam Gold, they're all heavy, heavy gamblers, either the crap tables or at gin or at poker. And I was always a big gambler in my life. So I took gambles by instinct, not by reason. It was just automatic for me to do that. And I suppose I hit a few home runs doing it, and I struck out quite a bit at times, too. But the homers make up for the strikeouts, as long as you get some homers in there, not just singles and doubles.
Well, I want to thank you a lot for talking with us.
Thanks for having me, Terry.
Robert Evans is the subject of the new documentary, The Kid Stays in the Picture. It's based on his 1994 memoir of the same name. Our interview was recorded when the book was published. The film opened in New York today and in L.A. today. It will open in more cities over the next few weeks. Coming up, John Powers reviews the French film Read My Lips. This is Fresh Air. Read My Lips is a new French thriller that was a hit in France. Our film critic, John Powers, doesn't want it to get lost in the swarm of summer Hollywood blockbusters.
A few days ago, I was talking to a television executive who was saying how brutally competitive things are in the cable TV business. If your show's not a hit, he told me, it doesn't exist. The same is true of foreign movies. Dozens open here every year, a high percentage of them pretty good. But except for rare hits such as Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, or Amelie, even the best ones come and go without leaving the slightest ripple. I fear this could happen to the new French film Read My Lips, which would be a pity. For while its entire advertising budget is far less than Hollywood spends on a single TV spot, this enjoyable thriller is far more gripping than either The Bourne Identity or Road to Perdition. Emmanuel DeVos stars as 35-year-old Carla Blem, the plain Jane secretary for a property development company, whose male execs treat her like a cross between a galley slave and a piece of furniture. Carla is largely deaf. She wears a hearing aid in both ears. Yet the deep source of her alienation is the sense that she's destined for a life of being professionally and sexually downtrodden. But all that changes when she's ordered to find a new trainee. She hires Paul Angeli. That's the terrific young star Vincent Cassell, who seems like the worst possible business prospect. He doesn't even know how to use a Xerox machine. But he is 25, handsome, and just out of jail. And from the moment they begin working together, Carla and Paul begin a process of mutual exploitation. While Carla uses Paul's skills as a thief to advance her professional career and maybe help her find sexual satisfaction, Paul uses Carla's gifts as a lip reader to help him with a crime. Read My Lips was written and directed by Jacques Audiard, one of those filmmakers who's cursed by being middle-aged rather than a hot young talent, and by being a good storyteller rather than a flamboyant stylist who can be marketed as brilliant. His last movie, A Self-Made Hero, was one of the best French movies of the past decade. The story of a young man who pretends to have been a hero in the French Resistance during World War II. Even as it offered an ironic commentary on how French culture rewrote its history, the movie, which is available on video, by the way, keeps you on the edge of your seat. You spend the whole time wondering if the hero's going to get caught and whether he deserves your sympathy. We feel that same kind of ambivalent suspense in Read My Lips, which is even more complicated because we're never quite sure where it's heading. Is this a love story? A black comedy? A heist film? Unlike today's hyperkinetic Hollywood thrillers, which are all about car chases and explosions, the thrills here remind one of Hitchcock, who knew how to keep menace at a human scale and how to root everything in the vagaries of human character. Neither Carla nor Paul is conventionally likable. He's got a jailbird streak of selfish thuggery. She's a veritable wellspring of resentment and bottled-up desire. Yet these two outsiders gradually transform each other. She helps make him something of a gent, while he helps her act out her antisocial impulses. They're bound together by great dreams and by shared guilt. Audiard underscores the story's psychological dislocations through an extraordinarily skillful use of sound, which is linked to Carla's hearing aid. When it's turned off, scenes are played in an eerie silence that heightens our sense of menace and gives the visual world a peculiar poetry. Without aural clues, we have to look at things more closely. When Carla clicks her hearing aid on, we're often assailed by noise that's all the more jarring because it follows such deep silence. The whole movie tends to feel either too loud or too quiet, which is precisely how Paul and Carla experience the world. What makes the story go is Carla's ability to read lips, which is also the movie's key metaphor. In fact, Read My Lips is finally about the freedom that comes when one escapes the ordinary realm of perception and starts picking up signs and signals that normally elude our senses. What initially appears to be Carla's great limitation, her deafness, eventually unleashes her strength. Able to literally see what people are saying, she's tuned into frequencies that the rest of the world is not.
Joan Powers is media columnist for LA Weekly. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Therapy is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sharrock directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Ask me again, who's the one I've...
That's a home recording of Rosemary Clooney with Michael Feinstein at the piano, performing a Gershwin song that had never been recorded. On the next Fresh Air, Michael Feinstein plays some archival recordings, and we hear his new CD. Join us for the next Fresh Air.